Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. It's Tuesday, November 23rd, 2021. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host here at Beer Sessions Radio. We're going to introduce our guests, and we're going to be talking about fermentation with Gabe.
Hey.
Just say your name and who you are for a minute.
How much would you like to know about me? My name is Gabe. Gabe Toth. I manage a distillery in Northern Colorado. I am a former brewer, wrote a book called The Fermentation Kitchen for the Brewers Association.
And that's why we're here today. And Brandon?
My name is Brandon Buza, and I go by the Instagram handle The Fermented Life. And it started with natural wines long time ago, decades ago, and just evolved into a lot of other exotic fruits and ciders and getting into distilled spirits, breads, so all things kind of related to yeast and bacteria and all the fun stuff.
So big picture, this is a new book from the Brewers Association, The Fermentation Kitchen, and it got sent to me a few weeks ago. I'm really liking it, but I want to just get your backstory, Gabe. Why did you write a fermentation book? You're a distiller. And what was the process of your own personal journey? Because I know you started as a home brewer. That was your first fermenting. But how did it go from that to an entire – it's actually really a cookbook about fermented foods.
Yeah. Well, some 15, 16 years ago, I graduated college. I was in Southern Colorado. Had learned to appreciate good beer, craft beer. And, you know, living in Colorado as I was. And I got my first job out of college in the mountains of northern New Mexico. And at the time, there was a single brewery and, you know, in the couple hundred miles from Santa Fe up well into Colorado, probably Salida. And so I was living in the mountains, not much to do in the off season when the ski lift wasn't running. So I started learning to homebrew, and that just sort of snowballed into, I love pickles. I'll learn how to make pickles, and cheese is awesome. Why not learn how to make cheese and all of these things just sort of piled up, charcuterie and then bread, and it all just sort of snowballed into a collection of hobbies.
Well, I'd say the book's really great. I mean, it starts with bread and it goes up to the end to different types of fermented sausages. Let's talk about what fermentation is, because let's start with Brandon. I think we had talked about this once not too long ago, and you made sure of saying that bread was part of this life of fermentation.
Yep. For me, it's probably a little bit like Gabe, but just, you kind of pick up one thing and then you pick up something else, all these little hobbies and it's sort of the always the desire to my desire to do everything. It's like, hey, it doesn't matter where you live, right? So I live in San Francisco, and hey, I'm going to make pizza, and I want to make everything. I'm going to grow my own grain. I'm going to mill the grain. Like, you know, people like, you can't do those things, right? Well, the more you tell me I can't do something, no matter how ridiculous it is, I'm going to figure it out. And I have done that. I like to say with the gentleman who I did this with, you know, we're probably the first people to grow grain and make bread from it in 100 years in San Francisco, but we did that and, you know, made our own cheese and I harvested a pig and did all the, it just, you know, can you do it? It's just the challenge of it and learning that process, that adventure, the curiosity. And obviously along the way, you meet a lot of other really interesting people who have these, you know, kind of passions and curiosities, and it just feeds on itself. But I think for me, yeah, there was a lot of, you know, people were like, oh, what are you going to focus on, you know, in your hobbies? Cause you're making bread at a high level and you're making cider and wine. It's like, you know, you got to pick one. And I always just kind of thought, that doesn't make any sense. I don't need to pick one. I'm going to do all of them. And I mean, clearly to be an expert, right, it is difficult to spread yourself across those things, but I've stayed in them. And I think making product at a pretty high level, I mean, I just want to best in class gold at Glencap for a cider. And so I know I'm on the right path and the product that I'm making. And you start to realize that there's way more in common, right? And I think even when I started into the distilling front and had a focus on heritage grains a number of years ago, there were definitely a bunch of people that are kind of like, ah, it doesn't matter. And kind of like sort of thinking, kind of looking down on that. And now all of a sudden that's all the rage. I mean, everybody's pushing into that. And so they're just, I think they're all these things are way more connected than they're disconnected. And I enjoy that. Right. And I think for me, you started to get into these things. It's like, okay, I'm with cider people who are not doing distilling. And I learn things that kind of are cross pollinate. Right. And that helps me in one area. Like, so maybe I learned something from distilling that helps me with cider or bread. And so it's that discovery, right. It's that continuing for me to learn, to be better educated, but also meeting other people that are curious and are teaching me and helping me in my journey. It's just this, you know, era time of just discovery and just getting to be more rounded. I mean, I love every part of it, right. From the people, from the conversation we're having today to, you know, the adventure of learning how these things work or rediscovering things that we knew 100 years ago and have kind of lost our way and have forgotten.
Oh yeah. No, and that's what Gabe touches on that in the book. Gabe, let's go back to the beginning, to the forward. So Kirsten Shockey, I know her. I interviewed her once about her vinegar book. How did you meet her and how did you get her to write the foreword for your book?
That's a great question for my publisher. you know, we actually lucked out a little bit. She has family. I live in Longmont, kind of north, a little northwest of Denver, sort of right in this Denver, Boulder, Fort Collins triangle. And she has family in Longmont also. So we were able to connect and sit down and chat a couple of times prior to the publication of the book. I couldn't really tell you how we got in touch with her originally, but she happened to be visiting Longmont when we were casting about for a
She's a big deal in fermentation, for sure, and that's a testament to your book that you've got Kirsten Shockey forward.
I was really excited to get her on board. I don't know if you've read all the way through to the bibliography, but I've got a couple of her books in there. And I was so disappointed. I really wish her vinegar book had come out just a little bit earlier because I didn't have a lot of good content to tap into there that was already out.
Yeah. Well, home-brewed vinegar is her thing. Hey, let's go to the bread. So the book starts with bread. What are some of the key things that you're recommending that people do when they're starting to make bread?
For me, one of the biggest things is to is to use more water than is traditional and to, you know, just abuse your dough less. Allow the extra hydration and a nice long hydration rest and, you know, a couple of folds, but not necessarily a heavy kneading of the dough. Just, you know, allowing the some folds to create a little structure and the action of your fermentation to really create your gluten structure when you're learning to make bread. You know, I love sandwiches. I love sandwiches. One of my favorite foods in the world, or I guess types of food. It's not a specific food, but for years I would go on road trips and, you know, I'd pack all this homemade stuff and I would make some baguettes and they were always disappointing. They were always heavy. They weren't bad, but they were denser than I wanted and they were heavier than I wanted. And I started just a couple years ago, started playing with, you know, use more water, do less kneading and do, you know, just a few folds as I'm, you know, as I'm fermenting my dough. And it, you know, it was like a thunderbolt. The first time I pulled out a batch from the oven, you know, I could feel it. I could feel the difference in the dough when it went into the oven. But when I pulled my baguette pan out of the oven and I picked up one of the loaves and it was just, it was like a balloon. It was just lighter than air. I was like, oh my God, that's it.
I'll just say one thing. One reason we're recording the show this week, it's Thanksgiving week, is that I thought I'd rather talk about this for Thanksgiving than turkey and and gravy. But and Brandon, so with you with bread, you know, what would you tell us about making bread for the first time? And how important is the sourdough culture for you?
This is a 10-hour show, right?
It's kind of.
It's complicated. I mean, that's the easiest way to answer it. I think it really depends on who the person is, right? I kind of feel them out and determine how focused they are. You know, everybody has a different level, right? I mean, my level is much different on what I'm willing to go through. And I work with a lot of heritage grains. I have two different mills, you know, depending on what I'm doing, I mill things differently. And so I'm expecting that most people are not going to be, you know, kind of to that level. And so I try to keep it simple for them. Right. So pick an inexpensive, high protein flour, something that's going to be easy to work with, something that's going to be very forgiving. And actually I would probably tend to give the opposite advice. I would, you know, kind of have people underhydrate. I think hydration, for me is a dangerous thing. I mean, I do most of my stuff by hand. I mean, certainly I have recipes, but everything's by feel and grain, you know, difference, right? I have friends in Vancouver, right? And the grains are getting, the Canadian flour is going to be different, right? It's going to function differently than if you're in Europe or if you're here. And so a lot of that is kind of how I would, you know, give me some basics about where you're at and how you're, you know, what flour you have access to, what the protein looks like, and just go with a simple, you know, kind of a really simple, straightforward recipe. And the starter, you know, there's a lot of, I think, unfortunately, that's how I really got deep into bread a long time ago, is there's just so much misinformation online. And I think people really tend to not fully understand how sour, you know, how like a native culture works. And, you know, a lot of, I think, to keep it simple, people make it very regimented and here you got to follow these, you know, kind of, but I've lived with my starter. I've traveled all over the world with it. It's been, you know, I put it through all sorts of kind of trials and, you know, it's a living thing. It's very durable. There are certain limits you can't press it past. And so I think I don't emphasize the starter as much. I mean, keeping it healthy and happy is one thing, but I'm not much one to subscribe that there's a huge difference. And I have yet for anybody to really prove that, hey, my starter in London is different than the starter that's, you know, on my grain in California. And even if it was, as soon as you feed it, whatever that local grain is, right, it's going to change. And unless you're going to the lab, you don't know what it is. you know, it's gonna change frequently. So that's a long answer, I guess. What I'm trying to say is, it kind of depends on who it is.
Well, that's why I'm kind of got a long day on Thursday and Friday for Thanksgiving, and I'm probably going to be baking a lot. So this is good for me. I remember also here in New York, She Wolf Bakery, Austin, the baker, does a great job at a couple home baker events. You know, we've had home brewer events, and now some of the regional grains groups have been doing home bakers. They would give out a little package of their wet starter. Which is pretty great. Gabe, what I like about the book on this note also is it's very introductory, but in a very sophisticated way, because even with the bread, you lay out some basics, but you say you're not trying to come up with this penultimate recipe. Rather, kind of what Brandon said, you're trying to give people the basic understanding, right?
Yeah, a lot of what I wanted to do with this was, you know, kind of explain to people, not just with bread, but all these different fermentations, you know, here are the levers that you can pull. Here are the impacts when you adjust these variables. And maybe you like a more sour pickle than I do, or you have different ingredients than I do, and you're trying to adapt those. You know, everybody who's out there making fermented foods has sort of this, obviously you have some level of creative drive, and I think we tend to have this kind of vision, or maybe just a general concept of, you know, what is my ultimate loaf of bread. And you know, it's going to be different than somebody else's ultimate loaf of bread, or their ultimate pickle or sausage or whatever. So I wanted to dive enough into the into those details, into those kind of variables that you can play with, to say, you know, here are the things that you can adjust. Go forth and make your perfect loaf, or your perfect pickle, or whatever it is.
No, that's great. You know, and also when reading this book, because you cover so many things, again, I said, you know, bread to salamis and things. What are some foods that people don't think of as fermented? So, you know, you've got cheese, pickles, you know, bread, beer, of course, and cider and things.
Yeah.
But there's other common foods that have a fermentation you know, you want me to tell you the ones I'm thinking of, or do you want me to tell?
Oh, sure. I mean, a lot of it is stuff that didn't make it into this book. And, you know, there's the possibility out there that we come back and do a more advanced version if, you know, if everybody loves this book and, you know, blows the doors off. But I think things like hard cheeses, people don't generally think of as a fermented food. You know, cheddar cheese or Parmesan, people don't always think of that as, you know, as a fermentation. Soy sauce. I think soy sauce is a big one that's overlooked in sort of the mindset that, you know, the sort of the general discussion of fermentation. A lot of these koji driven foods, you know,
I thought you just bought soy sauce in the supermarket.
What's that?
I thought you just bought soy sauce in the supermarket.
Yeah, it just comes in, like, it just naturally comes in those little packets.
Just pick it off the tree.
Pete, that's funny, going back to other books, Pete Brown, one of his books, he's written so many a couple years ago about the different ingredients of beer. He said that for many years, most people just thought beer was made of chemicals, didn't even know the ingredients. And I think when you mention soy sauce, my first thought is, yeah, doesn't that just come in the supermarket?
I mean, some of them are just mixtures of, you know, these processed ingredients, but really good soy sauces are fermented. Just like miso, they're just sort of a thinner version. I think vinegar is another one that people sort of overlook in the discussion of fermentation. You know, maybe less so now that Kirsten's book is out, but I think when you talk about fermentation, people kind of, you know, when you talk about vinegar, people go, oh, you know, white vinegar, you know, it's that pure acid, you know, pure acidic stuff. But then you go deeper into it and you're like, oh, well, what about beer vinegar or, you know, homemade wine vinegar? I think that one's maybe a little bit more in the conversation, but I think it's still very overlooked.
No, it's very interesting. You also mentioned things that we drink. So I'll say it, cocoa beans, cacao beans, and coffee. I never think of those as fermented.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I kind of knew that in the back of my head, but when I was reading it, I went, yeah, you know, you never really think about that. And Harold McGee in his book on food and cooking talks about this, the vast number of transformations that these beans of both types undergo. Some of it's enzymatic, some of it is microbial, but you're taking, in a lot of cases, unpalatable, undesirably flavored compounds and converting them into something just remarkable and delicious. Yeah, that's one that even when you ask the question, that's not a top of my mind response. Oh yeah, cacao and coffee.
Oh yeah. And Brandon, so for you, you must have a lot to say, because I know you do.
about which? For like just what? How do you mean?
Just keep the conversation going. Oh. Yeah.
yeah, I think when I make pizza, half the time I'm using fermented tomato sauces. And, you know, people are normally surprised by that. And that process, you know, especially, you know, when you go through that the first time, and you may have a little film yeast or something, you know, this white stuff growing on your vegetable or on your counter, you know, people think that's odd. And, you know, I kind of reminded how far I've come, you know, and things generally you see, you're like, oh, I'm not going to put that in my mouth. And now it's, you know, you're kind of like, you know, not fazed by anything that would probably will eventually bite me in the ass. But, you know, from strange apples or exotic fruits, you know, fermented things that look like they've gone awry. I think kind of tend to trust the process more, you know, knowing that you've put some simple measures in place, right? Adding a little bit of salt to, you know, kind of kill off some bacteria or not letting things go too far.
Yeah.
But just that process, right? It's really the conversation that keeps things kind of interesting. And again, I'm thankful for the community that's, you know, whether that's the baking community, whether that's the farming community for grains and, you know, produce and apples and things like that, to the distilling master distillers, folks that are just willing to share, you know, their experiences and continue to kind of motivate me, and then turning around and getting to share that with people. And I just like that engagement. So not everybody wants to go that deep. Not everybody cares about that sort of stuff, but there are enough of us out there that, you know.
Well, I was just thinking, if you want to go deep, like only mentioning Thanksgiving makes me think how excited I am for leftovers. And I'll probably just be saving most of it for some kind of a chili. But when I think about my sandwich, okay, I'll have turkey. But I think, Gabe, I bet you could make everything to go with that sandwich. So what would you make? What would you be serving with your turkey sandwich? Tell me the bread, condiments, whatever else you're going to make. Let's get that out there now so people can can celebrate this weekend.
Are we talking specifically Thanksgiving leftover sandwich?
Well, let's assume the only leftover you have is turkey, and everything else you already made or you're planning to make, like your bread or something.
So one of my go-to sandwiches, I'm a huge sucker for an Italian sandwich of any kind, but one of my go-to sandwiches, because you can't always shovel mounds of salted pork in your face all day, is smoked turkey, which is what I make for Thanksgiving.
You're already one step ahead. Look at that.
some sliced smoked turkey breast, fennel salami, and brie. And then something, a little acidic, might be mustard or spicy mustard, or maybe some homemade pickles, pickles and mustard, pickles and mustard and hot sauce, giardiniera, Italian, Chicago style giardiniera, one of my favorite pickled things. That sounds pretty damn good.
What kind of bread? A
baguette for sure. If we ever opened a sandwich shop, that would be, that would be the Gabe special. It would be smoked turkey, fennel salami, and brie.
I think you're going to see that on every brewery's menu soon.
I hope so.
If they read your book. Well, then, okay. So giardiniera, let's talk about that one.
Yeah.
So we think about pickled vegetables. And what is giardiniera? I mean, I know it's got different vegetables. You might have, to me, it's the kitchen sink, but.
Yeah.
Why is that? What makes it fermented? Like, what do the flavors do as opposed to just making like a quick refrigerated marinated vegetable?
So with giardiniera, you've got your baseline giardiniera, the Italian style, which is kind of the kitchen sink, as you're talking about it. Mine is normally cauliflower, red peppers,
carrots.
Onion, carrot, yeah. When I say red pepper, red bell pepper, whatever other kind of peppers might be growing in the garden. Not traditionally herbs, but I might throw some in if my time is going crazy or something. Just chopped up into bite-sized pieces, or bigger or smaller as you like. And those mixed vegetable ferments really, as they sit together over time, give you just a spectacular sort of flavor profile that you don't get from a single vegetable, a cucumber with dill, or green beans and garlic, and well, maybe dill. But then taking that a step further, that giardiniera, you've got your Chicago style giardiniera, which is mostly peppers and it's pickled, but after it's finished pickling, in my case fermenting, you drain it and let as much of the brine come off as possible, and then you pack it in oil. And I don't know if you've ever had this stuff, but it's fatty, it's salty, it's vinegary, because the vegetables are still, they're still acidified. They're just packed in oil. It might be spicy. It's hitting so many different notes.
So that's what you're talking about, the traditions of food. That's something that makes sense because it's fermented and then it's packed in oil. So that kind of predates refrigeration, right?
Yeah. And that oil, that oil adds a richness to your fermented pickle, your fermented vegetables. And it doesn't have to be lots of peppers. I've done it when I had a lot of cabbage in the garden, I made a very cabbage and peppery giardiniera. But that oil adds just this extra layer of fat, of richness. But it's definitely something that, as you said, predates refrigeration. It's a sterile medium.
It sounds great. And hold on, let's just mention our beers before we take a short break. I'm drinking Alaskan Brewing Company, their smoked porter. which you give the thumbs up to, right, Gabe?
You know, that beer was the inspiration for my very first commercially made beer.
Limited 2021 edition. A lot of writers got these bottles, and I think that it's worth it. And then what are you drinking? You're drinking an Odell's?
Yeah, I'm drinking a Mountain Standard IPA from Odell.
And you're right up there. You're like Fort Collins, right, Colorado?
Yeah, my the distillery that I manage is about a half hour from Fort Collins. So we like to support Odell. We like to support, New Belgium is right there down in Longmont. We've got some big breweries there too. We've got Left Hand and Oscar Blues. We've got a lot of good beer around.
Yeah, it's good beer country there.
But it's a good place.
Listen, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Check us out and become a member at heritageradionetwork.org. If you're listening before or on November 30th, don't forget it's Giving Tuesday, and you can give to us at heritageradionetwork.org. So we're talking about the Fermentation Kitchen by Gabe Toth, and we've got Brandon Buzza of The Fermented Life. So this is kind of cool. We've been talking about bread and fermentations, and we just mentioned a few beers. So, Gabe, you mentioned cooking, since I have the smoked porter, you mentioned cooking with beer in fermenting. So how can you add like a beer like a porter to a loaf of bread?
Porter is perfect for adding to bread. I don't know necessarily the upper limit. I've never gone as far as substituting, 100% of the water that I use in my bread with beer. I know that at a certain point, the acidity will start to affect the dough. But when you talk about, you need maybe a lot of the recipes in the book, I think call for about 750 milliliters of water. So what's a beer? I'm looking at my can here. That's in ounces. That's 12 ounces. But I think that's roughly half or maybe a little less of the water that you need in the bread. And a straight one for one swap there has been fine with me. Generally though, porter is awesome for doing that. Stouts are great. Lighter beers tend to get a little lost. I was really optimistic about making a bread that a nice big round loaf that was kind of saison, had a nice saison aroma to it. It did not. Tried using some sour beers. They added a little hint of tartness maybe, but it wasn't. It was disappointing.
What about the porter? Does it add sweetness? What does it add?
Oh, it'll add some sweetness. It'll add some richness, some smoke if you're going to use one of those fine Alaskan porters. Yeah, it'll give you just sort of a fuller, rounder flavor profile with the added sugars from the beer. You've also got those beer flavors. You've got chocolate and roast and smoke and all that stuff, you know, accentuating your profile.
So you could use a chocolate porter beer and make a pretty interesting loaf, right?
Yeah, you bet.
Oh, wow. Hey, back to Brandon. So, Brandon, it turns out you're a judge for the Good Food Awards.
Technically, I'm actually a co-chair, so I judge for other cider competitions, but I actually run the competition. So I'm not judging anything, but I, you know, we kind of walk through how we're scoring, and you know, we'll weigh in if there are questions or issues. You know, maybe it's not to category, or you know, to detect a fault. So anyway, yeah, so it's a little bit different role, but yeah, I'm deeply involved with Good Food, and in fact, just met with the new Max Kerwin, who's taking kind of the reins this coming year, and I'm excited about another year with Good Food, which entitles me to not only being involved on the cider front, but getting tied into a lot of other categories and getting to learn from a lot of other experts in, you know, olive oil and coffee, fish, cheese, you know, look, because they'll bring me and allow me to kind of sit in and judge some of these categories from time to time. Yeah. And it's just a fantastic organization.
In the expert category. How about this? Do you have a question for Gabe? Because it's like he's all knowing in terms of all the different types of fermentations. Is there one type of food you'd be curious about knowing, like a basic recipe or something?
Well, I will say that I have tackled, it's obviously something that's quite simple, but cabbage. And I know that there are very small, or at least in tasting other folks, sauerkraut, tasting folks with just the slightest of differences in how they go about that process. And I don't know. Let me put it this way. I don't have a recipe that I've really kind of fallen in love with. I mean, I put sauerkraut on everything, like from breakfast to lunch to dinner. And I guess I just don't make it routinely enough to have something I'm really, really a fan of. But I am curious if there, you know, he's got something that he's just in love with, a, you know, specific process or recipe that.
Wait, actually, my Thanksgiving sandwich, it might just be my leftover turkey with. I'm going to buy some sauerkraut and see a different cheese. So, Gabe.
You know, I don't have a single go-to method for sauerkraut. It kind of depends. Or for cabbage in general, you know, for sauerkraut, I might shred it, you know, salt it, pack it in a crock. I've had it dry out on me like that. I have done a brine in a more closed system in a jar with a weight, which has worked fine. Sauerkraut to me is, you know, I like sauerkraut. I have nothing against sauerkraut. I keep kimchi in my fridge though. When we run out of kimchi, I make more. When we run out of sauerkraut, I'll make more eventually. So I don't necessarily have a hard and fast, here's how I make sauerkraut, but I've found that, you know, just salting and pressing in a closed jar or brining both work fine. I like to add a little something. It might be mustard seed or dill seed or caraway. I've heard of shredding a daikon radish in with the cabbage to give it a little sweetness. You know, it sweetens up your sauerkraut a little, even after the fermentation. Actually, we did that a couple years ago at the New Mexico Fermentation Festival, and it was delightful. So,
Yeah, I think for me, sometimes the you know, it's the, you know, it's kind of the trade-off between having bread around all the time and not wanting to go through all the effort. So, you know, sauerkraut versus kimchi, you know, something that's a staple that's pretty easy to put together, right? So, you know, would I prefer to be making more exotic loaves most of the time, extended fermentations, soakers, kind of all that stuff? I mean, that's the preferred route. But sometimes you're like, you know, I really just want to have bread in the house that I made for breakfast this week. And, you know, I've only got whatever, 6 hours to do it, right? So I'm, you know, working on higher hydration, right? More temperatures. Maybe I'm working with fresh milled grains, everything to speed up enzymatic activity, speed up my process. So I guess I think of sauerkraut a little bit too, kind of like as a staple. What's, you know, something that's not not as involved as kimchi? And, you know, is there something that, you know, it's, yeah, kind of basic, but, you know, something that you, a go-to and you know, maybe some ingredient that people don't think about that makes a difference? Cause, I've made it, it's fine, but I've had other people's that seem like their recipes are similar, and it just, I don't know, to me, it tastes a lot better. So.
What was different about it? I would ask.
It's interesting you say that. Cause right now I have not made it for a while. But I was with some friends that I was trading some sort of exotic wines with them, unusual fruits. And they were trading me, a bunch of sauerkrauts that they had made. And I just remember it being, I don't know, a little bit brighter, just a little more flavorful. And, you know, why that is, I don't, you know, without sitting down and tasting it side by side to mine, I couldn't tell you the distinct notes, but I just, you know, you're caught sometimes, right? And even in the smallest little differences, you're like, I don't know what it is, but, you know, something that I'm drawn to, and you know, I want to put this in everything versus mine. It's kind of like, yeah, it's good, but, you know, I don't really need to put it on my sandwich. It's like, you know, just breakfast and eggs is fine or something. I don't know. It's subtle.
Yeah. And it might be the sort of thing that, like I mentioned, I'll add a little something in my sauerkraut when I'm mixing it up. It might be some kind of seeds. I would definitely try the daikon, shredding some daikon or some carrot.
And what are your feeling on using peppers? Any particular spicy peppers that are better than others? It probably maybe doesn't matter. Or do you do anything special?
When I made when I had cabbage just exploding in my garden, I went out and bought some serrano peppers and use those and some carrot and, you know, some regular stuff, garlic and onion. And that's what I made my giardiniera with the very first time. So I like serrano peppers. They're small enough to easily go into a relish, sort of, not necessarily a relish, but more of a condiment size. Green chilies to me, you know, I lived in
New Mexico,
in Southern Colorado and New Mexico for 15 years between the two of them. And I actually have a little jar of fermented green chilies in the fridge right now. The last of the chilies that I got at the farmer's market this year, just kind of keep them bright and keep them a little fresher than what I'm going to get out of the freezer section at the grocery store.
And actually that sort of reminds me of, it does remind me of another question, something I was introduced to a couple years ago in Colorado, on the western slope, western side of the state, was the black garlic. And obviously another fermented item, which for people who haven't had before, is absolutely fantastic. You know, curious if you're adding that to things, you know, whether you could add that easily, because you probably could, to sauerkraut, which I just never really thought about. And then do you make that? I mean, it's a process that I'm always threatening to do, and I have not done. So I have no experience in making black garlic, but it's so good. I need to.
Yeah. It's on my very short list of next. Well, it's really a very long list, but it's on, it's near the top of my very long list of next projects. I'm wrapping up my master's studies right now, and I'm really looking forward to next year. You know, black garlic is one of those, you know, we have a rice cooker and that's perfect for making black garlic from what I've read, from what I understand. You know, you want it hovering just a little over 100 degrees for, you know, weeks,
mm-hmm.
for several weeks. So I've used it. I've never made it, but it's on my radar for sure. In terms of adding it to things, you know, it's great with some mayo, you know, puree it, pulverize it into some mayo and, you know, put it on a sandwich.
I love it.
This isn't the fermentation.
This is the sandwich show.
It's the sandwich episode.
Now let's go. Okay, back to the book. We got, okay, you got some great quotes. Sander Katz. And what I love about the show is that everyone who's listening can look up all the stuff as they're listening. So, Sander Katz, the quote you give is, between fresh and rotten, you know, what are the boundaries, you know, when you're learning to ferment new things, you know, and tell us about the role of microbes and how these microbes are different than from yeast that you're brewing in a commercial brewery.
Sure. Well, the boundary is really where, well, the boundary is sort of where you're comfortable combined with what may or may not make you sick. And even that health factor, it can be very cultural. You know, there are fermented foods out there that you may have grown up, that if you live somewhere, you may have grown up with them and you may be acclimated to them, or you may have even co-evolved with these fermented foods and your body is, you know, it is your, in particular, your microbiome sort of evolved in the presence of these foods and you're, you know, you're perfectly happy and healthy.
So like maybe my people grew up eating yogurt, but don't drink cow's milk when they're adults, something like that.
Sure. As far as flavor, there's also, that's a huge factor. You know, I mentioned in the book, you might have a huge aversion to kimchi. My father not grew up, but worked, when we lived in New Jersey, worked in a setting where he associated kimchi with having to clean out these apartments. And, you know, the aroma of it had just soaked in. And, you know, the first time I brought it home, he just went, "Not again, never again. You're not doing this. You know, you are never bringing kimchi back in here, back into our house." But then if you go to Korea, they might look at a really nice blue cheese that you're super excited about and go, "Uh-uh, that's gross. We're not touching that." Icelandic fermented shark, you know, packed with ammonia. Not really anybody's first idea of, "Hey, I'm gonna dive into fermented foods, and I'm gonna start by making fermented shark."
Well, that's what they serve it with, a shot of alcohol.
Yeah, just try and keep it down.
Well, how about this? The pitfalls and the fears of fermentation. Like, there's that the B word, botulism. But I know, for example, that garlic can be very difficult to handle when you're trying to keep it. Like I used to make, when I was a kid, I just put I would put like strings of rosemary in a nice olive oil. But then I would also put in garlic, and I was told that you can't just put garlic in oil and leave it there.
Yeah.
But why is that?
Well, the microbe, Clostridium botulinum, it prefers, or it doesn't prefer, it requires an anaerobic, a zero oxygen, low acidity, sort of middle pH, 7-ish environment. And when you talk about what's an ideal environment for growing botulinum, olive oil is a big one. You know, if you look at I think it's the FDA reports annually in terms of food poisoning. You know, there's a huge rash of garlic infused olive oil botulism cases back in the 90s.
That's what I was trying to make it too.
it's associated with sausage also, because if you don't have salt alone won't prevent the growth of botulinum. Nitrates will help to keep it at bay. And if you have some acidity developing in your sausage, that will keep it safe while it dries. But if you don't have enough nitrate or enough acidity, then a homemade sausage, a homemade dried sausage it can be a time bomb. I've thrown away sausages that I tasted and I was like, this doesn't have enough salt in it. Like this could legitimately be poisonous. And
wow.
You also mentioned the
history and science of these traditional foods. So how did, before we had microscopes and, Louis pasteurization and other science, how did people for thousands of years know how to make sausage and oil cured fishes and all these other things?
Tradition, I suppose, and that's sort of looking at, why do we do it this way? Because that's the way we did it. That's the way Dad did it and Grandpa did it and Grandma did it. And going back all these generations, we do it this way because that's the way we've done it before and it didn't kill us. I always think about how did these things evolve? How many different types of iterations did you go through before you realized, okay, so this is safe, but this is not safe? How many people, how many people took a wrong turn down that path of, well, is this going to be poisonous or is it not going to be poisonous? Not that they understood what was happening microbially, but, taking a gamble.
So maybe that's why the emperors had tasters.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's a factor.
Wow. Hey, let's just cut. So back to you, Gabe. So you started as a home brewer. You were working in a brewery. How did you become a distiller? Because you're a top distiller. And what's a moment when you kind of went from brewing to distilling?
Well, I was the head brewer at Santa Fe Brewing Company for 5 some years. And, we were closely tied in with the local distillery, Santa Fe Spirits. No official relationship. No, two separate businesses, similar name, separate businesses. But the original distiller there came from Santa Fe Brewing Company. His wife was, and even now still is, the general manager there. And so when I started, we were making wash for them for their whiskey. We would mail a batch of grain to their specs and mash it and run off the wort. And then instead of boiling it and adding hops and turning it into beer, we would pump it off into totes that they would truck back to the distillery. And at a certain point, it was time to move on and do something else. And I looked around and thought, well, I like whiskey. I like gin. maybe I'll go do that. And I happened to know the people over there. They were looking for some help. So it was just an easy, natural transition. And I've moved back and forth a couple times. After Santa Fe Spirits, I managed the brew house at Twisted Pine in Boulder, Twisted Pine Brewing. After that, I came up here to the Family Jones, where I manage our production distillery. You know, I love doing both.
Well, it's great, man. Next time we'll have you on, we can do a dinner with your whisk, your spirits, and some of your fermented foods.
Sounds
it's really
lovely.
Great, man. The Fermentation Kitchen from the Brewers Association by Gabe Toth. Brandon, last thing. So for you, you know, you're a cider, you're all things curious, let's say that. And we do love you. but what about your other fruits? So you ferment fruits. How is it different? Because we're talking about microbes. How is making wine or cider different? Because like it's kind of a natural process. In some ways, you might just leave it. But you're looking for something different than what Gabe's talking about with food.
Well, I don't know about that. Right now for my wine efforts, I mean, I don't know how much I'll put up this year, 100 gallons or something. And that's a mix of, you know, it's a mix of pears and apples. And then with each year, as I sort of uncover other resources, trees, I'm adding the exotic fruits, and that's probably where I find the most excitement, mainly because it's, you know, the Europeans would say it's not uncharted territory, but in the U.S. it's relatively uncharted territory.
Like, so what, like quince?
Single varietal quinces. Yeah, I've been working with those quite a bit. I'm sure there's somebody out there that will correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know that there's more than four or five producers in the country that are doing 100% quince. There's lots of quince ciders, quince wines, and I make a distinction. American Cider Association, I don't think would, but the distinction, if there are apples in it, then it's quince cider. But if there are no apples, it's really a quince wine. And so I've been working with single varietals and trying to, you know, kind of establish I'm starting to build on my own rating scale for different quince varieties and astringency scales and stuff like that. And the varieties that I want to work with, which again, are all very limited quantities. So it's not like I'm putting up a, you know, 100 gallons of each. Going through that process, if you're not familiar with quince, you know, I mean, what I like about it is that, you know, you go to, when I went to some Michelin restaurants, I take my quince wine to pretty high end places and get their feedback. And people are, you know, sommeliers are just not familiar with it. Just don't see it. You know, the executive chefs and things like that are all familiar with it, but it's always in a cooked capacity. And so I just really enjoy that conversation. And, for me, when I came to the fruit and, you know, kind of just fell in love with the aromatics, and then I taste a lot of the wines that are out there, I just, for me personally, there was something more I wanted. I didn't feel like the fruit was being fully expressed. And so I've been on my own path and kind of creating a little bit of a different way of trying to get that essence of the quince into the bottle. And that's extended to some other rare fruits. Again, you know, they're small quantities, but there's not a lot of research. There's a couple people around the world that are, you know, working with medlars, for example. I mean, I did 100% medlar wine last year, and yet I have not found, I mean, you can get them in the Northeast for sure. You know, finding them is difficult. So I enjoy it because it's off the beaten track. Almost certainly I can go to, you know, very kind of, you know, famous cider makers, people that are deep into the industry, and they just have never seen it before. And so it's a fun conversation, right? It's an education.
No, I'm telling you, man, you're great. Hey, we're going to cut this off, but thank you so much. And I did want to talk about food for Thanksgiving week, and I'm glad we talked about the Fermentation Kitchen by Gabe Toth. So big thanks to everyone. Thanks to our engineer, Armin Spengen. Thanks to Gabe. and Brandon for joining me here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks so much, guys.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.